Let me introduce you to Dr. Julia Shaw. She is a researcher at the University of Bedfordshire in the UK who has recently done some very interesting work on false memories and implanting false memories. And I think this study says a lot that we all need to learn about whenever you hear somebody talking about something that they remember, whether it's from the recent past or the distant past, maybe it wasn't really a memory of theirs. Or maybe if you were talking about police interrogations where somebody is in an interrogation room for hour upon hour and a police officer is asking them about things that happened, maybe when they confess to that crime, it isn't actually what happened, but they're thinking that it happened. Not just to try to get out of that room and get out of that interrogation, but because at a certain point, maybe they've learned, they think, that those things did actually occur. Julia, welcome to the Big 550.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Julia is joining me via Skype from the UK, and if you're watching us online, you can see both of us on there as well. So tell me a little bit about the research and how you went about and conducted research into implanting false memories. Who agrees to have false memories implanted in them?
Who agrees? Participants. So in this study, what we did is we recruited university students who were willing to partake in what we called just an emotional memory study. So we didn't tell them it was about false memories, of course, but we did tell them it was about memory in general. And so these participants allowed us to contact their parents so that we could get information about their teenage years, their early adolescence. And what we then did with that information, that accurate information about these participants' personal past, is we took those real fragments, so such as the best friend of the participant at the time, where they grew up, and we wove these into very brief narratives, very brief stories, where we told these participants that they'd committed a crime that had never in fact occurred. And then after three sessions, each 1 week apart, these participants didn't just come to accept that they'd committed these crimes that we'd suggested they had, but they confabulated or filled out these details, what they were seeing at the time, what they were hearing, what they were tasting even sometimes, reenacting at times crimes they had never committed. So really what we would call fully internalizing that this had happened to them and exactly how.
How much detail were they able to remember about things that never happened?
A surprising amount, actually. So they were fleshing out dozens and dozens of details on average. In fact, to be classified as having a false memory in this particular study, part of the definition was that they had to have more than 10 details. And so what we had provided to them was the who, what, when, and where. So we said, for example, your parents indicated that when you were 14, you assaulted someone with a weapon and a police called your parents. And can you tell me, you were with your friend Paul, you were in San Francisco, and it was fall. Can you tell me everything you remember about this event from start to finish, no matter how trivial it may seem? That was the only instruction we gave them. And so from those very, very few basic details, they wove extensive stories that made sense within their life stories, picking out real places and real people, but putting them together in a way that wasn't real.
Were you amazed by that?
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'm amazed telling me about it and explaining how it works, and the fact that you told somebody, your parents said this happened, and we're not talking about when you were three, when your memory would obviously be a little bit fuzzy, but when you were a teenager, which means if you've got college students, it's just a few years ago, and they remembered it as if it had actually happened.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it was absolutely surprising. Even within my group of colleagues, there was disagreement as to whether it was even possible that the plausibility of this study would go over well with the participants and whether or not they would just completely outright reject the notion that this had happened to them. Never mind that they would then flesh it out to the extent that they eventually did.
What percentage of them did reject it and say, no, that never happened?
So 70% formed full false memories.
70%?
70%, which was about twice to three times that what we were expecting. Wow. So it was a very high success rate.
I'm curious, when you got to the point where they had revealed to you something that they thought was real but actually wasn't, and you told them later that it wasn't, what was their reaction?
So the reaction was surprise, because for the last 3 weeks, we had been engaging with these participants, and they had been convinced that they'd done this thing that had never happened. And so, of course, the first reaction was sort of a stunned silence, if you will. And then we had an elaborate debriefing where we explained just how it worked and the mechanisms behind why we could generate these false memories. And also, of course, we told them they could always go talk to their parents, who had never actually given us these memories that had supposedly occurred. So it was an overwhelmingly positive response after that, where participants seemed to really realize and be fascinated with the fact that they themselves could generate these confabulations, these false stories.
Were any of them adamant, "Oh, no, no, that definitely happened"?
There is definitely a few that what we would call were a bit longer in the debriefing phase. But after a few minutes, let's say 15 to 20 minutes at most, everybody came to, as far as we know, hopefully, really understood what had happened. So much so that a huge number of my participants ended up taking my lectures, my classes, the following semester on memory, because they are so fascinated about how memory does and doesn't work now.
What does this teach you as a researcher about police interrogations?
For police interrogations, there are a lot of applications, in particular for questioning, of course. So in my study, it was a friendly interview situation. So first of all, this suggests that even in police interviews or memory interviews in general, it doesn't have to be a threatening situation. It doesn't have to be good cop, bad cop to generate these false fabrications. It can be a nice information-seeking interview. So what that means is we need to examine even what we would now consider more neutral situations and how they might affect especially witnesses or even confessors, potential confessors. And also just to really avoid using what we call misinformation. So introducing what I did, the false details. You did this thing that I knew they hadn't done.
Yeah.
And just avoiding that entirely and not using those poor and suggestive retrieval techniques.
Is this something that can be taught? For,
yes.
I was going to say for the use of, you know, bad purposes.
Oh.
If somebody, let's say you're an unscrupulous law enforcement officer and you have somebody who, you know, there's pressure on you, close that case if you can, and you bring somebody in, could somebody learn how you did this with your students and apply it for the wrong reasons?
So this is a question I get asked quite a bit, and let's say it this way. I see no benefit of a police officer doing this. So you're right in that sometimes there is a lot of pressure to get a confession. But that's, especially in the United States, actually, that's the predominant model of interrogating someone is to gain a confession. Because in your mind, as a police officer, you've already asserted this person's guilt in your own, with other evidence, with other witnesses. So your goal is now to get a confession. That is different than your goal being to generate a false memory. So, because presumably you want a true confession. You don't want to get the wrong guy or the wrong girl. You want to get the right person and to have them confess. So intentionally generating false memories is not in anyone's best interest in that kind of situation.
How much is time a factor? I mean, how recent a memory could you implant, or how distant a memory, how far back in their life? I would think that the further back, the easier, because our memory kind of fades and we're not quite sure about things. But for something that happened a week or 6 months ago, could you do it for that?
An excellent question. And you're absolutely right that we know that we can implant these kinds of memories for younger events and for non-criminal events. So when you were six, you got lost in a shopping mall, for example. We know that we can do that. But research has yet to delve into more recent past. So my study was actually the first to look at adolescence, false memories in adolescence. So the next step would be to see adulthood. So can I convince you, exactly as you said, of something that happened last week or a couple months ago or yesterday? And theoretically, from the mechanisms and from what we know about memory, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do that. In fact, we do that with each other unintentionally all the time, where we change each other's memories unintentionally by telling them to our friends and them disagreeing, for example. So it should be possible, but it hasn't been done yet. So definitely a question for future research.
I'm sure you know that there are people who, let's go back to the unscrupulous side of the business for just a moment here, people who call themselves therapists who engage in what's called regressive therapy and end up implanting memories in people about how they were abused as a child when they actually weren't, or other things that were done to them. This happens a lot in divorce cases where one parent convinces a child or has somebody else convince a child that something bad was done to them by the parent who they may want to divorce, etc. Does this fall under the same field as what you're talking about?
It does fall under the same field. In fact, that controversy, especially in the 90s, there were a lot of lawsuits. There was a lot of regression therapy happening, and people were coming out saying that they had been satanically, ritually abused by their parents, or especially their fathers often, and things that were impossible, not just implausible, but impossible. So, for example, it was found out that the dad was away at war at the time. So not only is and there were no scars. So there are these very, very vicious, very vivid legal disputes about things that never happened. And what we found out from exactly those settings is that these can arise unintentionally, presumably, in therapy, where therapists put too much pressure and put too much value on the accuracy of memory from things happening a long time ago and using questionable and suggestive methods. So that certainly still happens today, hopefully less so because there has been a shift in the way we treat people in therapy. But it's definitely another application to just any memory, anyone who talks about memory, and how they interview them, how they delve into our personal past. It has applications for there.
Julia, I can see you being called as a witness by somebody trying to defend against such a claim. They bring you in and say, yeah, I was able to do that too. It's bogus.
In terms of an offender who actually did commit a crime, you mean?
Yeah, or no, not a crime, but one of those regressive therapy kind of things that maybe we're talking about them from 15 years ago, but there would still be some evil people out there who would try to pull that sort of stuff off if the money was right, and then they could bring you in and say, okay, maybe you did that, maybe you didn't, but here's a professor who was able to do it herself, so we can't believe anything you say.
You keep using the term evil. I would rather use the term misguided.
Okay.
So especially, just like in police officers, I don't think there's any actual benefit for therapists to intentionally implant false memories. It's unintentional application of poor retrieval techniques that where they think that they're getting reality, but they're not. And so they're facilitating these false memories unintentionally, I think, predominantly. Within that, as an expert witness, of course, what I would come in and say, at the very least, is I can never say whether something actually for sure happened or didn't happen. But what I can say is whether there are red flags. So in a therapeutic setting, for example, what was the questioning technique? How did this progress? Did the person come in with this memory or did it develop over time? So same with police interrogations. I'm not one to come in and say this is true or this isn't, but I am one to say this is more questionable or this is less questionable.
Here's my last question for you. And by the way, okay. I think that there are evil people in the world and they would still do that, but I will leave that aside. My last question for you is this. Now that your work has been published and people know who you are and what you do, how are you going to get volunteers to do this in the future without walking in with some sort of preordained memories already ready to go?
So you're absolutely right that they need to not know that that's what the study is about when they come in. Otherwise, they're expecting it, and then it's not going to work. But you'd be surprised how many people don't read science news, especially undergraduate students or people in various countries around the world. Yeah. Most people aren't on top of this stuff. And even if they are, they don't necessarily know what to look for.
Yeah.
So that, in addition to me using research assistants, they don't know it's my research. They don't know it's me. It's certainly still possible to continue this line of research.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're so right about the world not following what's going on in science, which is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on here to talk about this. Congratulations on your work. Good luck with it as it goes forward. I look forward to hearing more about what you're able to do screwing with people's brains.
That makes it sound less nice. Let's go with educating and learning about memory.
Evil, good. Evil, good. I understand. Julia, thanks so much for joining me.
Okay, thank you very much.
Dr. Julia Shaw is a researcher at the University of Bedfordshire in the UK. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.